Lecture 10, Darwin and Responses to Evolution.
The most active and controversial issue in the science-religion relationship nowadays is certainly that of evolution. I'm sure there's been much more ink spilled about this one topic than all the rest of the science-religion controversy put together. It remains a topic that evokes emotional responses, and I should say, to equal degrees on both sides of the issue. Unfortunately, emotion tends to put reason to flight, and in this case, we are in greater need of reason than emotion. In this lecture, we're going to speed through the major points of Darwin's theory and contextualize them in relationship to currents in science theology conversations of the time. We'll also survey reactions to Darwinian evolution down to the end of the 19th century. In the next lecture, we'll move on to the 20th century to focus specifically on reactions in 20th century America, particularly in relationship to the rise of fundamentalism. So, without further ado, let's review the main features of Darwin's evolutionary theory. Charles Darwin proposed the major features of his evolutionary theory in two books, in The Origin of Species, published in 1859, which was followed some years later in 1871 by The Descent of Man. There are three basic features to Darwin's proposal. First, common ancestry. This holds that all species originated from one or a small number of ancient organisms. Now, a lot of the emotional impact of Darwinism originates here because human beings are included in the evolutionary tree. The fact that this is a raw nerve is revealed by the tendency of critics, both in the 19th century and down to the present day, to make indignant exclamations about people coming from apes. A claim, of course, which is not made by Darwinians, who actually posit a common ancestor, neither ape nor human, from which both apes and human beings descend. Second is the concept of variation by mutation. This deals with how new species arise from old ones, namely the forms, organs, and instincts of an individual can differ in small and random ways from those of its progenitor, and that these new characteristics can be passed on to the next generation. This point proved far less controversial. The third point is natural selection as the mechanism of speciation. Now, although there may be any number of variations, they are not all equally passed on to the next generation. Variations which prove to be useful adaptations that promote an individual's survival will thereby enhance reproduction, and so are passed on to a larger number of offspring. In this way, useful variations are selected for. This point was hotly debated both in science and in theology. It was also translated out of the biological realm and into the social realm by Herbert Spencer and others. Spencer cited it under the slightly misleading motto of survival of the fittest. More about that problem in a few minutes. Now, some contextualization. The second half of the 19th century was a period of enormous upheavals socially, intellectually, technologically, and politically. I'm going to have to restrict myself because of time considerations just to the intellectual ones. The two issues we treated last time are of particular importance. First, the age of the Earth was still being debated. There were still mosaicists writing popular books in particular, even though geology had become by this point a thoroughly professionalized field. The age of the Earth is crucial since Darwin's mechanism of speciation would require a very old Earth, certainly much longer than the 6,000 or so years of mosaicists. Second, higher criticism remained a very hot topic of controversy, particularly in England, and it was something that clearly distinguished different theologians into different classes. Finally, I have to stress that evolution was not a new topic in 1859. What's new in Darwin's case is specifically the mechanism of natural selection. Evolutionary changes and variations had been talked about since the 18th century. In fact, Charles Darwin's grandfather Erasmus Darwin was involved in these early discussions. The 1840s and 50s saw heightened awareness of the topic, even on a popular level, thanks to a very controversial book in the natural theology tradition called Vestiges of a Natural History of Creation, published anonymously in 1844. The Vestiges proposed, in a very engaging popular style, it's an easy book to read, that evolutionary development of the world was the natural course of things. This author, eventually identified as Robert Chambers, wrote, and I quote, "All of creation developed gradually in accordance with natural law." But the natural world was not the only place for evolutionary thinking. The intellectual and political world embraced evolution as well. I'll remind you only of Auguste Comte's three stages of human intellectual endeavor, development, so beloved by John William Draper. So Darwinism appeared on an already turbulent scene, one deeply interested in, concerned about, and divided over many of the topics that Darwin would highlight. Now, Darwin's ideas impinge on several theological issues, most of which we've already encountered in other contexts. The simplest instance, Darwinism had an impact on biblical authority, specifically in terms of interpretations of Genesis 1. Nothing new there. Thus, those who held to strict, that is, more directly literal interpretations of the Bible, tended to reject Darwin's ideas. What is striking, and what I have to emphasize, is that in the 19th century, this was the weakest objection, and the one, it may surprise you to hear, most easily overcome. Much more problematic was what the idea of random variation and natural selection did to a tradition that was by now thoroughly entrenched in English-speaking culture, namely natural theology and the argument from design. This foundation, upon which English religious apologetic had been built for almost two centuries, was undermined by the notion of random variations in natural selection. In short, the awe-inspiring anatomical features, rather than being exquisite contrivances that bore witness to divine design and wisdom, were now to be seen as the cumulative product of eons of minute random variations selected naturally and statistically by environmental pressures and more successful reproduction. In short, what we sense as design is in fact a natural result of inherent natural processes, like the fact that all the planets and satellites revolve and rotate in the same direction, or the intricate structure of snowflakes. So we're back at an old problem. The problem of God's activity in nature. If new species can develop naturally and without the need for special creation, that is, individual production by the hand of God, then here's another place where God's direct action is not needed. In other words, the natural theologian's God of the gaps was being squeezed out of yet another closing gap, and a very big one, in fact. Thus, Darwinism threatened English religious apologetic with progressive collapse. If random variation and natural selection undermined arguments from design, that weakened in turn natural theology, which had been supporting the bulk of English apologetics for the existence of God. Thus, fear about atheism became, again, an issue via fear of the argument, no design, no God. This concern came out most straightforwardly in the 1874 book by the Princeton Presbyterian theologian Charles Hodge, entitled What is Darwinism? Towards the end of his book, Hodge answered the question bluntly. Darwinism is atheism. Significantly, Hodge came to this conclusion largely on the basis of the impact of Darwinism for natural theology. He found it, quote, absolutely impossible to believe that the eye is not a work of design. And further, denial of design in nature is virtually the denial of God. Well, Hodge's theology envisioned a God working directly in the world. He was not satisfied with distancing God from creation via a chain of secondary causes. What kind of a position is this? Do you remember? This is a supernaturalist position. God is exerting his direct action on the world all the time rather than having delegated powers to natural things. Well, I know that we should always be very wary of conjectural history. By conjectural history, I mean what if history. How could things have turned out differently? But in this case, I think it's fairly safe to conjecture that if the English-speaking world had not built up so large a tradition of natural theology for almost two centuries and had not come to rely upon it so heavily for the single proposition of God's existence, then natural selection would not have provoked so strong a religious response. We can deduce in support of this claim the fact that the reception of Darwin outside of England and America, where natural theology had far less currency and importance, was quite different. The theological issue that was particularly troubling on the continent was the danger of materialism. Remember, we spoke about materialism when we were talking about the mechanical philosophy. It's the idea that everything can be explained in terms of matter and motion, and the concern that this left no room for spiritual entities that are at the center of religion, God and the soul. In the present case of evolution, the origin of man from lower organisms by natural processes was potentially materialistic unless exception was made for the creation and infusion of the human soul. Materialism had already grown into a tumultuous movement on the continent by 1859. The ideas, particularly of German materialists, undergirded radical politics, most notably those of Karl Marx. And this radical politics, in its assault on the established political order, also included strident materialist attacks on Christianity, which was, of course, allied with the established political order. The support evolution gave to materialist thinking was actually a factor in its acceptance by some. One example is the German biologist Ernst Haeckel, although he did not accept Darwin's mechanism of natural selection. Indeed, Haeckel is the most strident atheist that we have yet encountered. In 1877, he wrote, "The cell consists of protoplasm, composed chiefly of carbon with an admixture of hydrogen, nitrogen, and sulfur. These component parts, properly nursed, become man. With this single argument, the mystery of the universe is explained, the deity annulled, and a new era of infinite knowledge ushered in." Wow, there you have it all. Materialism, atheism, scientism, all wrapped up with astonishing arrogance. We'll have more to say about this blend of notions in our concluding lecture. For now, Haeckel's bold claims illustrate the problems we're talking about and make it clear why materialism was one of the philosophical positions condemned as an error by Pius IX, and again a few years later in 1870 by the First Vatican Council. Finally, in terms of emotional impact, if not necessarily in terms of rational theology, many people objected to the common origins theory for man because they found the lower animal origins undignified and unsuitable for the being created in God's image. Still, some religious leaders did not find this a problem. One example is A.H. Strong, an American Baptist, and one strongly on the conservative side in terms of biblical authority and interpretation. He argued in his 1886 book, Systematic Theology, that humans are no less human even if evolved from beasts, just as, he says, the wine that Christ produced from water at the marriage in Cana is no less wine for having once been water. It's a beautiful comparison there. Perhaps the most important point about evolution is that early 21st century listeners should know is this. 19th century religious leaders and theologians expressed almost every conceivable response to Darwinian evolution. It would also be a gross mistake to think that theologians and scientists divided up into opposite camps based on Darwinism. Theologians and scientists both were scattered from one end of the spectrum to the other in their responses to Darwinism. Some religious leaders like Hodge did see evolution as undermining Christianity. And we've just seen how some materialists explicitly used it for just such a purpose. That's one end of the spectrum. But a great number of religious leaders saw the general concept of evolution as consistent with the divine plan, and some saw it even as proof of a divine purpose. In other words, evolutionary schemes could be summed up and put into a new kind of natural theology. The necessary background to all of this is the book I mentioned a few minutes ago, Vestiges of a Natural History of Creation, published in 1844, 15 years before Origin of Species. The book envisioned a progressive evolutionary plan that was programmed into creation by God at the beginning. The world was evolving, all according to a providential divine blueprint that had been encased in natural laws. For some, there might have been theological problems with determinism here, but the Vestiges brought a theistic version of evolutionary thinking to a very wide public. A sense of progress in nature spoke to ultimate purpose and design. Now, Darwin, in his later years, rejected progressivism, that is, that evolution means constant advancement. But this, in fact, others said, was hard to argue from the fossil record, which by and large shows more advanced forms later in time. The idea of progress in nature harmonized beautifully with Victorian ideas of social and political progress as well. So there's a harmony here with the idea of evolution and ideas in the wider culture, including religious culture. Now, Darwin's ideas were co-opted by a wide range of thinkers, and may I say they then evolved into new forms by being subjected to new environments and new pressures. They could be used, just as we saw in the last lecture in terms of age of the earth, to support completely opposite points of view. Here's an example. The principle of common ancestry and variation argues for the emergence of a first man, the first creature able to be called human, from whom all later humans are thereby descended. This view is known as monogenism, single origin. Such a view can support biblical teaching that all mankind is related through Adam. It thus can undergird, for example, the doctrine of original sin, and by direct consequence, that of universal redemption through Christ. It could also undergird the fundamental Christian moral principle that all men are brothers, and thus the ethical, moral, and behavioral obligations that flow from that idea. Yet, others used the very same principles to argue that humanity had several origins through several original human beings evolved in different parts of the world. A position of polygenism, many origins. Now look where this idea, which by the way, is formally condemned by the Catholic Church and many Protestant theologians, where will it lead? Well, when combined with social Darwinism, Spencer's Survival of the Fittest, polygenism gives a scientific justification for racism and colonialism. This was a useful perspective, by the way, for business and political interests at the time who were benefiting from England's imperial expansion in the 19th century. Just as Haeckel's declaration that politics is applied biology was co-opted 20 years after his death to justify Nazi race policies. In the American South, polygenism was called to support the institution of slavery. Well, another surprising notion is that sometimes religious motives played a positive role in accepting and spreading evolution. That may sound like quite a surprising statement. But some liberal theologians, those who embraced higher criticism, for example, were anxious to distinguish themselves from conservatives and evangelicals who stuck to biblical literalism. So acceptance of evolutionary thinking, generally modified in one way or another, could be a way to define a particular intellectual and social group among Christian theologians. In other words, by accepting evolution, you put yourself in a particular group and separate yourself from another group that you don't want to be associated with. So acceptance of evolution could be a mark to indicate that you are a modern and enlightened theologian. In 20th century America, we can easily see just the same social phenomenon happening in reverse. Remember, you can never define just one group. Defining one group always defines two. Drawing a line of demarcation marks an inside and an outside. So through the 20th century, there has been a tendency for the less educated, often less formally educated, to assert and reinforce religious identity through opposition to evolution. Opposition to evolution becomes, in effect, a badge of membership. Indeed, some recent American sects define themselves in practice as much through opposition to evolution as by adherence to any specific theological doctrine. Well, so far we've dealt almost entirely with Protestant responses. Catholic responses provide further possibilities for the engagement of theology with evolution. Protestants, as we've seen, tended to worry about the conflict with literal readings of Scripture to some extent, but more about the implications for natural theology and the argument from design. Catholics, on the other hand, who tended, in general, to be neither biblical literalists nor wedded to a natural theology tradition and its argument from design in the way that English Protestants were, responded in different ways. Catholic responses tended to be more muted, and they were directed primarily against materialism and polygenism. The key points for discussion among Catholic theologians thus were, and in fact remain to the present day, the divine origin of the human soul and the consanguinity of the human race. One early response from a Catholic scientist, actually he was a convert to Catholicism in England, was The Genesis of Species by St. George Mivart. I should say, St. George is his first name. He's not canonized. That's just his first name. He was an anatomist. He, like so many scientists of the day, opposed natural selection as the mechanism of evolution, even while accepting biological evolution in general. He propounded a theistic view of evolution, bearing some resemblances to what was set forth in The Vestiges, namely that the evolutionary process was divinely guided in one way or another. For him, God had established laws of development that evolving organisms follow. As evidence, he pointed to separate evolutionary lines, that is, separate lines of descent through different groups of organisms, that showed similar progression occurring independently, implying for him that they were guided by some yet unknown natural law, rather than by chance variations in natural selection, which would not be expected to produce similar anatomical changes in different organisms in different situations. Moreover, he explicitly noted that the soul was an immaterial entity and could not be a product of evolution. Well, the hardening of some Protestant positions against evolution in the early 20th century that we'll talk about next time did not have a counterpart among Catholics. Indeed, Catholics remained largely silent during the heated arguments of the teens and 20s we'll survey next time. But in 1950, Pope Pius XII, in his encyclical Humani Generis, of the human race, allowed for discussions of evolution between theologians and scientists, but at the same time noted that while it was certainly praiseworthy for the Church to take into account as much as possible demonstrated scientific knowledge, evolution remained at that point a hypothesis. Does that sound familiar? Well, it should. It's the same cautious sentiment that we've heard from Saints Augustine and Bellarmino regarding science and theology. Pius XII also took the opportunity in this encyclical to note that evolution can regard only the origin of the human body, not the soul. Well, a more recent and celebrated statement was that of John Paul II in 1996. Here, he reiterated opposition to materialistic interpretations. The soul exists and is not a product of evolution. But he also updated Pius XII's comments. I quote, "Today, almost half a century after the publication of the encyclical Humani Generis, new knowledge has led to the recognition of the theory of evolution as more than a hypothesis. It is indeed remarkable that this theory has been progressively accepted by researchers, following a series of discoveries in various fields of knowledge. The convergence, neither sought nor fabricated, of the results of work that was conducted independently is, in itself, a significant argument in favor of this theory. Now note the careful use of proper philosophical terminology. John Paul was, after all, a professor of philosophy. Evolution is no longer a hypothesis. Well, what's a hypothesis? It is a provisional statement, a supposition in the process of being tested. But John Paul calls evolution a theory. Well, is that something different? Yes, it is. Even if it's not necessarily so in common parlance, there is a big difference. The word theory, properly used, does not mean a guess or a supposition. Often people contrast theory and fact, as in the dismissive statement, "Oh, that's just a theory." But that is incorrect. A theory is not something waiting to be proven, to grow up into a fact. A theory is something far greater than a fact could ever be. A theory is a well-supported explanatory structure capable of explaining and predicting a range of phenomena. A fact is just an isolated tidbit of knowledge, but a theory organizes facts, concepts, and predictions into a functional scientific framework. So, for example, the theory of gravity explains and predicts planetary motions, projectile motions, and falling apples. But no one says the theory of gravity is just a theory. So, what John Paul II was actually doing was updating Pius XII's statement. Evidence accumulated in the intervening 50 years between the two statements indicated that evolution now has the status of a theory, that is, a powerful organizational structure for biology. I'll just point out that this really is exactly the kind of thing that St. Augustine was asking for back in his De Genesis ad Literam, the literal commentary on Genesis, that once scientific knowledge progresses, we have to adjust our biblical interpretations, our theology, to accommodate it. Now, back to the 19th century. The 30 years following Origin of Species was a time full of discussions and divergent positions in theology and science in regard to evolution. The most hostile responses were particularly the early ones. By the 1880s, a shift was apparent, and that was a shift towards accommodation. By the end of the century, there was nearly universal acceptance by both scientists and theologians of the concept of biological evolution in terms of the transformation of species, but considerably less for natural selection as its mechanism. Viewed from 1900, Darwin had been wildly successful in advancing the general concept of evolution, but, ironically enough, was less successful in promoting his own particular contribution to the topic, that is, natural selection. Most conflicts with Genesis had been solved. By century's end, many theologians had adopted higher criticism, which read Genesis 1 as a creation myth containing spiritual truths, but in a highly poetic language. Most who did not adopt higher criticism had settled on the day-age or gap theory. We met the day-age theory last time. It holds that each of the 6 days of creation represents a vast geological epoch. The gap theory allows for the insertion of vast period of time between the days. Thus, the vast age of the Earth was no longer an issue if you are a gap theorist. In terms of the fear of atheism or materialism, by the end of the century, many of these concerns had been allayed by the concept of a theistic evolution. That means that evolution was a natural process guided or directed in some way by God. But note, theistic evolution was not some watered-down version of evolution. It wasn't evolution light for theologians. It was developed by scientists and widely accepted by scientists, who, remember, then as now, were just as likely to be theists anyway. theistic evolution was worked out extensively by one of Darwin's major American proponents, the Harvard botanist Asa Gray, who concluded that variation has been led along certain beneficial lines. Now, Gray's system was politely rejected by Darwin himself. Yet, theistic versions of evolution proved very powerful, being adopted by many, including, for the case of human development, by Alfred Russel Wallace, the independent originator of natural selection. Well, we've already talked about different positions regarding the level of God's involvement in the natural world. Theistic evolution recapitulates these different positions. That is to say, the level of God's involvement with the evolutionary process could span a very large range. At the most naturalistic end, after God's initial creative act, evolution just proceeded naturally to form man's body, which, once complete, God put a human soul into. So this lecture brings us to the end of the 19th century. In our next lecture, we're going to continue looking at responses to evolution, but in the 20th century, particularly in the context of that peculiarly American construction, fundamentalism.